Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona. It's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio by three very interesting folks. We're going to have a fascinating conversation today about the franchise industry in Arizona. To my left is Chad Barnett, president of Foods 2000, Inc., and also president of the Subway Advertising Board. Welcome, Chad.
Good morning, Adrian.
Marissa Felker is a franchise banking manager at Washington Federal. Thanks for coming in, Marissa.
My pleasure. Thanks, Adrian.
And Jeff Wolf is a national franchise attorney at Quarles & Brady. Welcome.
Good morning, Adrian. Thank you for having me.
Chad, start us off a little bit. Tell us about your company, about your kind of role in the industry, and how you're serving folks through the work you do.
Absolutely. First of all, I'm feeding the hungry. That's what I do. So we're a Subway franchise here in Arizona. We've got 48 restaurants all over Arizona. And then we, of course, we give back in other areas. But that's my day job is making sandwiches.
My kids love Subway. It's something that, you know, folks are familiar with when they see them all over the place, but they may not realize the way that Subway operates as a business. How did you get started? When did you become a franchisee? And what's a little bit of the backstory?
Yeah. So the name of our franchise company is Foods 2000. We started that in 1990. And really, it was, this sounds horrible, but it was to get out of the real estate market. So back in the late 80s here in Arizona, the real estate was awful. And we ended up getting into the Subway business just to kind of rebound from real estate a bit.
Yeah, I understand. I want to hear more about your journey along the way and kind of the scope of your work now. Marissa Felker, you're a franchise banking manager at Washington Federal. Tell us a little bit about your role and how you found yourself in that position.
I've been with Washington Federal for about a year. I've instituted their franchise lending program. I've been in franchise lending since 2000. I was with Citigroup in New York, and when I moved to Southern California, there was only one commutable Citigroup group, which I knew nothing about, and that was franchise, and that was in 2000. So I was recognized as someone with expertise, and Washington Federal, otherwise known as WAFED, wanted to start a franchise program, and that's how they brought me on.
And what was your experience prior to that? What made you such a good fit for that challenge?
Because I'd been in the business for so long, and I understood what the challenges were, how the industry worked, how to make connections in the industry, the trade shows that you have to show up at to show that you're serious. Knowing how franchise works, it's so much different than other types of lending that they didn't want to struggle and not put a good foot forward. So that's why they asked me to come on, because I had that expertise.
Wonderful. I want to hear more about specifically how the financing works and some of the interesting things folks may not be aware of. Jeff Wolf, you're a franchise attorney at Quarles & Brady, large national firm. Tell us a little bit about your role and how you got into that.
Sure. I'm a partner at Quarles & Brady in the Phoenix office. We are approximately a 500-lawyer national law firm in 11 different cities. I work with the franchise and distribution industry team within our firm, help lead that practice. And what I do is I help primarily franchisors from startups to more mature developed companies with their franchising activities, represent them in litigation involving franchisees, consumers, third-party vendors. But really, we do a soup-to-nuts kind of representation in the franchise industry. And we're kind of unique in the sense that we have probably the most the largest practice in that area in Arizona and the Southwest. And I've been doing it for most of my 32-year legal career.
Now, how did you find your way into franchising? I mean, take us back to young Jeff going to law school. What was your vision for the future, and did it look anything like what you're doing now?
It looked absolutely nothing like what I'm doing now. And I had absolutely no idea what franchising or what franchise law was. And I got into it quite by accident, based on receiving a chance phone call I was working as a young and very new associate attorney in an insurance defense firm in Mesa, Arizona, and I was learning trial work. I was probably only 2 years out of law school, and I barely even knew what a client was, let alone what franchise law was. And I got a call from a guy who was a friend of mine in sleepaway camp in the Poconos of Pennsylvania, who was the cook. I was one of the counselors, and he was a year ahead of me and had gone to law school. Long story short is that he worked as an in-house attorney with a hotel franchise company based in New Jersey that owned two little hotel brands, Ramada Inn and Howard Johnson's. And they had a case in Mesa. And so he figured out that I was there and asked me if I would be interested in handling this case for the company. It involved a dispute with a former shareholder. It wasn't even a franchise-related issue. But from that relationship, I ended up growing a significant franchise practice. I actually tried the case that was that he had referred to me, got the client a good result, and then the client started to evolve and buy up other hotel brands, real estate brands, car rental brands, and it turned into what became the world's largest hospitality franchise system called Sendin Corporation. And within about 5 to 8 years, I was doing all of their litigation in 5 states in the Southwest. And that was in the early 90s. And fast forward to today, and I have a much more diversified franchise practice that covers, as I mentioned earlier, a variety of different things, helping, you know, forming and structuring companies and then the dispute resolution side as well.
It sounds like there's a lot of unique aspects and complexity on the legal side, I'm sure, on the financing and on the operations and marketing and all the other pieces as well. Is this something that any qualified business attorney can do, or what's the unique value somebody gets by finding somebody with your depth of expertise?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, there is no typical specialized training or education for franchise lawyers. I'm not aware of very many law schools that offer even a franchise law class. So it's something that I think is unique. It is a specialized area, and really the way to develop the expertise in it is to is practical experience over a long period of time, preferably learning from a mentor or even learning on your own. But to answer your specific question, it really is not something that the average business attorney could do without having some form of training or continuing legal education or self-study. It has many nuances. It's a regulated industry. So first and foremost, you have to be aware of the FTC regulations that apply to franchising nationally, and then as well as the individual states in which the franchise activity is being conducted, meaning sales of franchises. Certain states have regulations, certain states don't. Certain states have industry-specific regulations. Some states don't have any regulations. So you really have to know the landscape pretty well, and it's not something that a typical business lawyer would know from taking a business law class.
I wonder if the same thing is true on the business owner, business operator side. Chad, when you first got into franchising, it sounds like there's a level of complexity and uniqueness to this type of business model. What were some of the initial challenges, or how did you find your way as you began to learn on the execution side about this business?
I think one of the best things about a franchise is the support that they offer. And so in my mind, it's the best of both worlds. We have the system, we have the support, we have the tools, we have the brand recognition, but yet at the same time, we get to be our own boss. We get to make our own decisions and run the company the way we want and treat our people the way we want. And so I love it because it marries both of the two together.
Marissa, are you finding there was something similar in your experience? You're now a recognized authority and expert and able to set up the kind of program that you've done at Washington Federal. If you wound back the clock a bit, it sounds like mentoring and kind of learning the specifics and on the banking and financing side of franchising, was that important? And how did you do that?
It's huge. When I joined City Capital, as their franchise group was called in 2000, they couldn't find anyone who had franchise expertise. Nobody did. So they had to hire people from middle market. I came from a background of middle market and private banking, and I had no franchise expertise. They hired you in, and you learned. And I was there for 8 years, and day in, day out, dealing with franchisee programs, dealing with individual borrowers, dealing with the attorneys, dealing with the doc process, dealing with the franchisors, because they have requirements that they impose upon the franchisees. So it's a trilateral arrangement. And so you just learn those things as you go along, and there's a lot of pressure to do it right because you're doing right by the bank and you're doing right by the client. And that's how I learned. So they just dropped me in the vat and said, sink or swim, and I started swimming around.
Yeah. And here you are. Is franchise lending different from other forms of lending? How significantly different are the products you're working with versus other sections of the bank?
Loans are loans, however you look at it. But the client base is very different. You're dealing with multiple locations. You're dealing, like I said, with a third party that's involved in your relationship. That third party can be very supportive. Sometimes there's contention. Sometimes there's the client is not prepared to meet all the obligations that are required by the franchisor. So those are things that are typically not part of a normal middle market lending relationship, which is usually one company, one building, one set of books, one borrower, without having that third party involved in the decision making and in the risk profile as well.
That is a good point. The franchisor, the company, and then the franchisee, the actual business owner in a specific location or territory who's running multiple things. How does that relationship evolve? Do you find yourself sometimes being the go-between, or are they pretty much coming to you together and you're on the other side of the table?
It's incumbent upon the banker to understand the obligations that the franchisee has to the franchisor. One of the things that is a big factor in franchise lending is CapEx, capital expenditure, because franchisees and franchise systems are constantly going through a process of rejuvenation. And they need to remodel their stores on a consistent basis in order to get their franchise agreements renewed. And so franchisees need to have some dry powder for those capital expenditures going forward. Sometimes remodel initiatives, and I'm talking about food franchises primarily because that's what I do. Sometimes those mandates are onerous, difficult for the franchisee to comply, or they're just not strong enough financially. And so the banker has to be able to work externally and internally so that their internal folks know that there are these challenges on the side of the franchisee, on the side of the customer, and for the banker to always be aware of what those mandates might be coming from the franchisor. So it's that dynamic that really, I think, differentiates franchise lending from other types.
Jeff, do you find yourself in a similar kind of role, or are you pretty much dealing with one or the other? In other words, the franchisor or the franchisee. Are you ever in a situation where you have both parties in conversation with you?
My practice and the practice of Quarles and Brady is primarily on the franchisor side. And it's similar to, if you know anything about how employment law works, or sometimes other areas like personal injury, it's very common to be on one side of the fence or the other. And the reason for that is that there are some peculiarities that are in the relationship between the parties, particularly the contractual relationship that binds franchisors and franchisees. So it's kind of hard to be on both sides of the street. So we typically counsel franchisors only, and franchisees will be, in the event of a dispute of some kind, will be on the other side of the table. That being said, we do help multi-unit franchisees quite a bit, which is a larger kind of an entity that may own, you know, even more than one brand. Sometimes we will counsel them on matters that don't have to do with the franchise relationship. But more often than not, we are only dealing with the franchisor side of things.
Chad, as president of Foods 2000 and also chair of the Subway Advertising Board, there's a lot of different franchises represented there. Give us a sense of the scope of it. How many franchises would you say across Arizona?
Yeah, in Arizona, there's about 450 restaurants, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say there's probably about 80 franchisee groups here in Arizona.
What are some of the common themes, common issues that, you know, from both your own company and then from that broader industry role that you see playing out over and over again? You've got a number of years behind you now. What do you know about this business that other folks may not know?
Well, it's amazing how the business changes over the years, but it all goes back to the people. I mean, and that's what I tell our team all the time. We happen to make sandwiches, but we're in the people business. And that's a challenge because there's no two people alike. Whether you're dealing with the customers coming in or the employees on the other side of the counter, it's a people business. And so that's really where we try to remind ourselves that we're dealing with people and not sandwiches necessarily.
How are the Subway franchises in Arizona unique as compared to other either restaurant franchises or the gyms, the other types of franchise businesses? What are some of the unique features and dynamics?
Well, obviously the size of our brand, we've got probably more restaurants here in Arizona than any other brand or any other franchise. But one of the things unique that we've done here in Arizona is some of the franchisees got together and we started our own nonprofit. So back in 1999, we started Subway Kids in Sports. And so we focus on children, and we try to provide children who couldn't afford to sports equipment or different entrance fees to sports and things like that. And we do that. And that's the only franchisee-run charity that I know of here in Arizona.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Good work that you're doing. The Subway brand as a whole seems to have its own cycle to it, certainly as an early proponent of healthy eating. Then, of course, with the challenges the company faced with issues with its former spokesperson, and then now Subway shows up everywhere. But maybe from an outside perspective, I might not have the correct view on this. What's the current status of Subway as a brand in the mind of consumers, would you say? I'm making a leap here.
Yeah, but we're an older brand. So obviously, you know, we started in 1965, so we're over 50 years old. By the way, one of the things I find most people find interesting is we today have over 44,000 restaurants. And so if you do the math on that, for the last 53 years, on average, two restaurants or more have opened up every single day since that first day in 1965. So I think just the size of it is crazy big. But again, if you think through that and the complexity, that means in every way. In other words, we've got more owners, we've got more personalities, we've got more, so it's just... It's a good thing, but it's just interesting how large it is sometimes, in my opinion. Right now, though, we're transforming who we are. And so Subway is really doing a great job of that, from the way the restaurants look to our menu innovation. Everything about the brand really is being refreshed, if you will.
There certainly seems to be, from the consumer side anyway, a trend over the years of co-locating. You know, you find more Subways in gas stations. And is this just as the changing dynamics of retail and leases and other things? I mean, I'm completely ignorant about the real issues here, but it seems that I'm able to find Subway more places in smaller footprints than what I remember from, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Is that
That's been a trend for a while, co-branding. But again, the beauty of the Subway is you can put it in a small space. You know, we can go into very small spaces. The typical is probably 1,300 square feet, which is a typical inline space in a shopping center. But the beauty is you can make them fit anywhere. We've had them in, obviously, in the normal places like sports universities, but we've also had them in churches and I read an article once, there was a mobile subway that as a skyrise was being built, it was on a trailer and it was going up the building, you know, and so they would complete the floor and it would go to the next floor. And so it's amazing to me how creative and innovative they can actually put a restaurant in.
Marissa Felker, from the banker's perspective, as this evolves, what are you seeing some of the trends and challenges people are facing in the industry as a whole? Well, the restaurant franchise industry is the part you deal most with.
What I'm seeing the challenges are the traffic ticket conundrum. Everyone is chasing value. They're trying to provide value to their clients. And that value results in a lower ticket. So there's constant pressure to keep the margins up. And generally, it's a thinly margined industry. So, and those are mandates that come from the franchisor sometimes, and then you have to worry about how your the mix of the costs of the food that's inherent in that value proposition. So that's an ongoing challenge. And so as bankers, we're always looking at the profitability, the EBITDA of our clients, and that's something that we're focusing on. We're seeing another challenge is high labor rates. Labor is increasing all the time, and in certain jurisdictions, it's really increasing. So there's countering to that. So they want to get the traffic up, and they're doing that with delivery. Delivery is what we're seeing is really big, and people are starting to invest in the technology, in the apps, in the delivery apps. And then we're seeing kiosks popping up all over, and franchisees being tasked with investing in all of that technology in order to keep up, because it's very, very competitive. It's competitive in segments. Like, you've got a lot of competition in the chicken segment, in the hamburger segment, in the Mexican segment. And then you've got competition against a segment versus segment, because there's only so many family food dollar, eating out dollar in the pie. And they're all vying for that. And it's very, very competitive. So as a banker, We're watching to see who is doing well at the competition game and maintaining their margins and who is maybe struggling. And so as a banker and a risk manager, we have to be cognizant of that.
Jeff, you agree with that? You see the risk side from the franchisor lens. What role is innovation and this need to develop new technologies, new business models? How does that show up in your professional framework?
It's huge. I mean, it's a significant part of both the challenges of franchising and as Marissa pointed out, part of the cost structure of franchising, and that cost structure within the franchise relationship typically is passed on or shared with the franchisee, and franchisees are not always receptive to change, particularly when it involves some capital expenditures. So that's a challenge. But there clearly is a trend, toward toward incorporating a lot more, technology into brand concepts, into branding, and into the operational side of franchises. And so observationally, I can say that I see those things. I don't always get involved in them from in a legal context, although that does happen, where franchisees are resisting change, or they don't see the brand value in having to make additional investments that often their franchise agreements will require them to make.
And given the way that things are going, I can only imagine a scenario where somebody's a self-piloted drone delivery vehicle for tacos or whatever is absolutely going to change the somebody at some point is going to say, well, we've got this bright idea, but maybe we should check with legal first and see if this is going to fly literally or not. So much on the, as Marissa pointed to, on the consumer experience of franchising is related to the way that they get the product or experience the product. And there's a lot happening. None of it has really remade the landscape yet. But it seems anyway like this change is coming. Different ways of getting the product in the hands or mouths or whatever of the masses is going to inevitably involve AI and self-piloted vehicles of one form or another. Is any of this, Chad, showing up on your radar at Subway, or is it still just way too early for someone who's operating an actual business in 2019 to worry about that stuff?
Well, absolutely. In fact, Marissa, I was just going to compliment you on your rundown. That was like perfect.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it was very good. We're looking at all this. I mean, it's crazy to me how the technology has changed our business over the years. You know, it's the people business and it's food, but the technology, it's amazing from how we do things behind the scenes operationally to ordering food and writing schedules. But obviously, you know, Subway being with its size, we signed a deal with third-party deliveries to deliver our food. And we had to do four different companies just to encompass the size of the brand. And so last time I looked, it was 9,000 or 10,000 Subways are now delivering around the U.S., into our app. You know, we get all the time, you know, customers are ordering through our app. And so the technology is just driving it, even to the way we market. And so as a board locally, we're finding that we do more and more digital marketing to connect with the consumers, you know, one-to-one.
And the opportunities there, I mean, as somebody who has played in that realm, the opportunities there are extraordinary for account-based branding, where you can target people based on their activity, based on their location. I mean, none of this started yesterday, but it still is seeming to be early in many ways. I noticed last year that I was following Google Maps directions, and it said, turn right at the Taco Bell. And I thought to myself, you know, that's not an accident. Somebody is paying to have their properties used as landmarks in another product, the beacons and other things that let you know there's a Starbucks half a mile away. I, you know, get a notification. I'm like, I'm not so bothered by the privacy aspect of this as some people. I'm fascinated by the innovation and the direction it's going. What are some of the challenges that come with that? I mean, obviously it's a business. So you've got staff, you've got schedules, you've got supply chain stuff, you've got all the customer service related aspects of running a business like that. What are some of the things that show up as unique in the franchise world, or is there any? Is it at that level? It's a business.
Yeah, good question. I'm not sure that I can speak to the whole franchise world from our perspective. I feel like it can't happen fast enough. I mean, technology is just changing so fast and so rapidly, and I feel like there's always the next iteration coming out. And so in my mind, it just can't happen fast enough to the technology to catch up where we want it to be. And at the same time, sometimes I feel like it's going too fast. I mean, it's crazy how fast, but yet I want it to be faster, if that makes any sense.
I mean, I completely can relate. I grew up with technology partly because I grew up in my dad's radio station. So our first computer was a VAX mainframe that was the size of a gymnasium, you know, and all the way through to today. It's just crazy to me what we can do with these incredible devices in our pockets and purses. Jeff, it seems from this outside perspective that I have that franchising makes up a significant part of the retail landscape, at least in a certain type of, you know, the restaurant space and others. Is that accurate? Can you unpack a little bit for us kind of what the scope of franchising is in the broader retail industry?
The scope of franchising, as you can imagine, is incredibly broad and very significant throughout the retail markets in the U.S. And over the course of probably the last 20 or 30 years, the International Franchise Association has tracked data on how much of a percentage of the U.S. retail industry is made up with franchising businesses or franchise-related businesses. And there's a lot more there than meets the eye. And that starts with the fact that there is, that there are a couple of different kinds of franchise models. You could franchise, a handyman business where the business operator is working out of a home or working out of a truck, and you can franchise a big box retail store and maybe not even realize that it's a franchise. But ultimately, in the statistics that I've been aware of, maybe I went back a little too far, but starting maybe about 10, 15 years ago, the IFA started coming out with statistics that showed that 45 cents out of every dollar spent in a retail U.S. retail context was spent in a franchise-related business, which I found to be incredible. That number is probably closer to or maybe even exceeds 50 cents at this point. So out of every dollar spent in the U.S. on anything related to retail, which I'm including food and beverage, hotels, clothing, just about anything that a consumer would purchase is spent in a business that is connected in some way to franchising.
You mentioned that a lot of your work is with the startup franchisor, where someone gets an idea. Let's say I see, you know, small meditation studios popping up around, you know, the orange theories of mental health, if you will. I've got this vision. I know that I want to go in on this. I've got a few partners. We've maybe lined up some startup financing. We're not sure yet. At what point in this do I need to sit down with you or somebody with your expertise to really nail down how to set this up properly? How does that play out in the startup phase?
Well, the answer to that is a little bit complicated. It's a little bit based on the individual situation or the specific circumstances. There's really no precise formula by which you would go about doing a franchise startup. You don't have to have, you know, X number of stores or X number of potential franchises or franchises lined up. In fact, you shouldn't have that because it's illegal to sell a franchise without having first complied with, you know, with federal and sometimes state law. But it really depends on the situation. Having the capital resources to invest in the process is really significant.
The dry powder Marissa speaks of.
Exactly. And it's not necessarily for the legal components of setting up a franchise. It's really for the operational components of successfully running a franchise company. Because there are people out there who are really good at operating a yoga studio. They've got some good brand value, and they've got some, you know, they might have something very unique about that particular form of yoga, and hopefully they do, because that, you know, they need something to distinguish it from the next yoga studio. But what
cold yoga,
right?
I see this.
Right.
Sub-zero there yoga.
There you go.
It's a winner,
right? With
cryo yoga. Yeah, I think we're onto something here, and good thing we've got a banker in the room. Yeah. We can
yogas in parkas or something
right.
like that.
Right.
But the key to that is that you need to you might be a good yoga studio operator, but you know nothing about operating a franchise company. Who is going to go out and sell the concept to prospective franchisees? What infrastructure do you have to support your franchisees and help them to be successful? So there's a lot that goes into that. And sometimes we'll talk to people who have the greatest idea since sliced bread, but they don't have the capital, they don't have the human resource component, they don't have a business plan. So everybody's a little bit different, but I would say that the first thing you need to have is what I would refer to as a franchisable concept, you know, something that can be replicated. And that really runs the gamut of, you know, a million different things. I mean, virtually, you know, anything can be replicated as long as you can create, as long as there's some branding that goes with that and some unique aspects of the business that you can protect through licensing and intellectual property protection. But it's a complicated thing. The first and foremost thing is having a good idea. But close to right behind that is you need to have the capital in order to build the company. You can't just expect to have the idea and sell it to somebody and not have to, you know, do anything to help them be successful in their business, because that's what franchising is all about. You know, franchising 101 is leveraging a business concept, and you need to know how to build that second company.
Yeah, for sure. Marissa, I'd love to get your perspective on what Jeff is talking about here. I don't know how much of your portfolio would be those early phase franchisees versus the established ones. But what are some of the significant things that, let's take the meditation studio or my cryo yoga idea here.
I like that one, right? Really clever.
Folks, if you're listening and you want to run with it, you'll hear how to contact these people at the end of the show. They'll get you set up.
There is such a thing as cryotherapy franchises now.
Right.
That's a real thing.
Yeah. But this is yoga in the tank.
Cryo yoga.
Don't cry yoga. I like what we're creating here, you guys. Marissa, once somebody is at the place where they're really wanting to run with this, is that a point where they should be talking to the banker, or are you dealing more with, let's say, the franchisor structure is established and then a franchisee wants to come in? At what point in the conversation do they find themselves sitting across the desk from you trying to get the money they need keep their powder dry?
Our program is designed around established franchisees. So those are people that 10-10 is the little catchphrase we use, 10 years in business, at least 10 stores. But if it's a great operator and he's got 7 stores, or if he's been in business for 7 years, you know, it just depends on the operator. And the operator is key. A strong operator cures all ills. Even if you've got franchisor problems, if you've got a strong operator who has the level of independence that he needs to run his business competently, that's the kind of person that we want to talk to. But I had a question for you, Jeff. In your practice, and I've always been curious about this, how many company-owned stores does a franchisee or franchisor establish before he's in a position to start franchising out? I mean, are you seeing that people just have the concept and the rules and regulations and then they just franchise it out, or do they have a level of company-owned stores where they've worked out the bugs and they kind of really are experts in the concept that they've started?
That's a great question, and my answer is going to be a little similar to my answer to Adrian's question earlier. Mm-hmm. There's no formula. There's no bright line test where a franchisor has to have X number of stores, but really the rule of thumb, I would say, is that if it's a brick and mortar business, you pretty much should have some, you know, at least one prototype, should have a track record of profitability in one or more company-owned locations. That's ideal. I mean, but there is no minimum number. I mean, you could literally franchise a concept without having a company-owned location, and many franchisors do that. It really depends on the concept. When I first started working with Massage Envy about 15 years ago, right out of the box, they had one corporate-owned store, and it was really a store that was partly owned by one of the original founders of the company, and they were off and running using a regional developer model very quickly, and were able to sell 200 to 300 licenses within the first couple of years of operation. So, and that was really off of one store, and I'd say brick and mortar. Yes, you definitely want to have the prototype. If it's not brick and mortar, if it's internet-based, if it's home-based, you don't really need to have that. But, you know, when you want to sell franchises into states like California or Maryland or Illinois or New York, which are heavily regulated states, the regulators sure as heck want to see what your audited financials look like. And in order for you to sell a franchise, you have to have as part of your franchise disclosure document your first year's audited financial statement. So that's something that people are going to be looking at, and it certainly helps if you've got some degree of a proven track record, or you've got money in the bank, you know, one or the other. Money in the bank and a good idea works also, but having a prototype store is also going to help you to validate what you're selling. So in order for people to invest their hard-earned money and sometimes their life savings, They want to see what it is that you have. They want
proof that the business model works.
Exactly. They want to touch and feel it, and they want to go into a Subway store or whatever the case may be, and they want to know what it looks like and feels like. So that really helps when you're out there selling. But I've seen it all. I've seen companies that start from literally scratch with nothing but a good service-based franchise concept or something that they can sell, a product. It doesn't have to be a brick-and-mortar type of a concept.
Chad Barnett, take us back in time to your first Subway. Before that, what were you thinking about as you were looking to get into a new kind of business? Was it clear? Were you trying to weigh several different choices as to what to get into? How did that play out for you?
No, the two partners that I work with, really, I joined them by the hip. Life before Subway, I was in the food business. I was running, I was actually on the franchisor side of things, working for a yogurt chain that franchised their locations out. And was tired of traveling, wanted to start a family, hated traveling, so decided to do something locally. Met the partners I work with now and just hit it off.
When you came in and Subway was already established, that was the thing.
Correct, yeah. So Foods 2000 started in 1990. I joined the team in 2000. And back then we had 12 restaurants. And
right. So they were already, neck deep in toasted sandwiches by the time you got there.
Well, we weren't toasting back then. But yeah, they were neck deep in sandwiches.
Right. What do you, if you meet another business owner, an entrepreneur, maybe they've been successful in something, they're looking for a transition, and they discover that you have this experience in franchising, what are some of the primary questions they're asking, or what are some of the questions they should be asking that they're not as they look at possibly getting into this?
I think one of the funny questions I always get is, how much does each one make? And it's like, there's 44,000 of these. I mean, they're all across the gamut. Which I just find interesting. And the other thing I would tell people is you have to love people. I hear all the time people talk about businesses they've opened in fact, just this weekend I was talking to someone who opened up a bar and a restaurant and he was complaining about the people and the staff that he has to work with. And so especially a franchise like we operate, if you don't like people, this is the wrong business for you to be in.
Marissa, when you are seeing the rise and fall, the success or struggle of different franchisees or different businesses in general, what are some of the common characteristics? What does somebody need to do well? Is it all come down to the people, or do you have another take on it as well?
Well, I tend to look at things from the financial standpoint. From the people side, if the franchisee doesn't have that honed, he's going to get sued. A lot. There's going to be problems with the personnel, disgruntled personnel. There's political issues these days where people are finally tuned to forms of harassment or discrimination. Those things can come up if you're not managing your personnel. What I see most of the time is not so much that franchisees are taking too much out of the company. They're just not managing their margins well enough, and it's very challenging, so it takes a lot of talent. Also, too, you have to know real estate. You have to figure out the right locations and manage your real estate. So if you've got a location that's inherently not profitable just because of the nature of the market area, you have to be agile, work with the franchisor, figure out a way to replace that store with another store under the same franchise agreement so that your overall profitability is maintained. So it's the day-to-day operations, watching those margins, making sure that the people are happy. You have to make your customers and your employees happy, and managing that real estate, knowing what's going to work and what isn't, and as I said, just making sure that you have the capital to take care of the remodeling mandates that are sure to come from the franchisor.
It's a really valuable perspective. Talk a little bit about Washington Federal and about what's unique. If somebody is considering a franchise business and they need to secure financing, what are they getting with Washington Federal that is distinct from maybe some of the other financial institutions they might be considering?
I think the most important thing is that Washington Federal has taken the time and spent the money to establish a bona fide program that caters to the franchisee space. And our program right now is food only, so it is the large, nationally recognized fast food, QSR, quick serve restaurant franchisees. We've got, one, the expertise, and number two, we've got the legal team, and it's actually an outside firm that helps us with our documentation and any legal issues that we may have. So that what the franchisee is getting is something that is dedicated to the franchise space, which is very different from the C&I space, the commercial and industrial. And if you're not careful and you don't know what you're doing, franchise tends to devolve across over to private banking, where they don't understand the business and they go, okay, if you've got a lot of liquidity and you'll guarantee, then we're good. But that doesn't really show that you understand the industry. So I think the industry expertise, and having been in the industry for a long time and knowing a lot of people in the industry, I think that makes a difference rather than trying to force or accommodate a larger program, which would be middle market lending, and adapt it to franchise, because I think the franchisee won't be well served with that, as well served as they would be with Washington Federal.
You mentioned earlier about innovation and technology, and Mike Brown, regional president of Washington Federal, was in here a month ago. We talked about specifically the impact this plays on financial services. Is there an extent to which the brand of banking as a whole is shifting as so much more in terms of internet products, financing, internet checking? I can't remember the last time I went into a branch for myself personally. Now my kids, we opened a credit union account and we did that kind of thing. But the nature of banking as a whole is changing. And yet franchising is often, although as Jeff pointed out, not always, a local brick and mortar presence. So is having a banking equivalent to that still important even in 2019, as branches are closing down in many places because the cost of the space and the staffing is so significant? What's the future of banking for franchise?
Well, the thing about franchising is that it's a national business, because franchise systems are national. So you don't need a lot of infrastructure in order to meet that need. You have to be able to travel, and you need to, with email, texting, the telephone, all the legal documents that go back and forth, all of the analysis that goes, it's all done electronically. So I could work from home if I wanted to and still have the same impact. So franchise lending and the franchise program doesn't really require the brick and mortar. Now, brick and mortar is shrinking, as it should. And even in the franchise space, people are finding it very attractive to move to a smaller footprint because it's more profit per square foot, less rent, more efficiencies. So I don't see a big impact on my space from technology, except for one thing, and that's in the treasury management space. That's managing the accounts and the transfer of funds. You've got a number of different stores, a lot of accounts. You need a place to consolidate all of that, and you need security. You need information security encryption that is going to protect the client. And from that standpoint, that's where I see the innovation on the payment side and on the treasury management side. That's where we have the most opportunity, where we can leverage technology.
Chad Barnett, it's maybe not often, or maybe it is, that you sit down in a room with the deep experience on the banking and the legal side, as we have right here in the studio today, or maybe this is common, I don't know. What are some of the things that have been challenging for you with regard to the financing, the legal side, or that you see maybe could be done better? What's the future hold, and how would you improve this from the operator's point of view?
From the banking side, just getting all of our all the paperwork. I mean, to me, that's crazy. And I know technology helps with that, but we just went through a big financing run, And oh my goodness, the emails that go back and forth is just crazy. And I know most of the time they're covering themselves, but they're copying half the emails I don't need to see, but I'm copying on them. And it's craziness. But I love the fact that you know the business so well. I can hear just in the way that you speak that you know the business inside and out, which is awesome.
I mean, that little rundown earlier about the relationship between traffic and ticket, and value, I figured out halfway through what that all meant. The kind of specificity is what somebody's getting when they come to Washington Federal to work with your team. They're getting that deep knowledge. What are some of the opportunities? What are you excited about, Chad, both for Subway here in Arizona and nationally? What's on the horizon that you're looking forward to?
Well, nationally, the Subway brand is spending $80 million to refresh our units, and so that's fun. We'll finish that probably in April, and that'll be new menus, new products, new uniforms, just a new look, new beverages, so I'm excited about that. But locally, again, just excited about what we're doing with Subway Kids in Sports. We've given over $1 million, helped over 50,000 kids, and so just really fun to be a part of that.
What are some of the programs available through Subway Kids and Sports, and where would folks get involved if that's something they wanted to support?
Great question. We actually give money to a ton of different charities, but one of the things that we do that I think's the most favorite that impacts me, I love kids, is we do a program called Cycle for Success. And so we go into a local school and we reward kids for being a good role model, if you will, just for positive things. So it's not, they weren't the track star, they weren't the spelling bee champ, nothing like that. But they just were being kind to other people, or they were being helpful to the teacher. And so we reward them with a new bike, a new helmet, a Subway catered lunch. And so we do that every month in two classrooms. And that's just a ball. I mean, it's so fun to watch these kids. Usually they're underprivileged schools, Title I schools, but to just go in and surprise the whole class. We generally like to have the parents sit outside, and so we'll congratulate this student without saying who it is, and then have their parent walk in, and that's when they know they won the bike, and it's just awesome.
That sounds really cool. Jeff, as you look forward to the future, what is exciting? What's on the horizon? What is challenging? In other words, some things coming at us are positive, some are less positive. What are we looking at as you look into the future?
I think in terms of the future of franchising and looking at it through the lens of where we are right now in 2019, I think we're going to continue to see a lot of growth in the industry, both nationally and in Arizona. And while I'm definitely not an economist or an expert on things like that, I do a fair amount of reading on those subjects, on anything to do with franchising, and I know that in Arizona, which is most important to me, although I do practice around the country as part of my national firm, I think that franchising is going to continue to be on the rise in Arizona. It's something that ties to the overall population growth as one of the main drivers of franchising. It ties to employment growth. It ties to the economic output. And when you look at those factors, Arizona is probably in the top five of U.S. states in franchising growth, which is exciting to me because I think that means that things are going pretty well in our local economy, and you know, not surprisingly, I mean, Arizona's part of the Sun Belt region and Sun Belt states like Nevada and Arizona and even Utah are going through some pretty rapid growth right now, and that's going to mean more opportunities for all players within the franchising industry, and hopefully for folks like me who have kind of carved out a niche in that space within the legal profession. So That's kind of what I see. And as long as, you know, the economy continues to do pretty well, I think that's what we can expect. And that's really coming now out of, you know, for the last 10 years or so, 8 to 10 years coming out of the recession, which, you know, I'm sure the other folks in the room, you know, have some insights on as well. But I think we're going to continue to see a lot of new franchise systems. We're going to see growth within or among mature and emerging systems, you know, in all kinds of concepts that, you know, that are what I like to think of as recession-proof kinds of concepts. You know, whether that means, child care services or pet care services or hair cutting or the fitness and health concepts. You mentioned Orange Theory earlier, and that's one of the fastest growing franchises in the country, with now over 1,600 franchisees, and it's just going off the charts. So I see that. I mean, franchising has become my life somehow from that first phone call 30 years later. But that's kind of what I see. It's a big question, and obviously a little bit of a long answer.
Well, it's amazing how many things in life start out as strange historical accidents.
Yeah.
The summer camp was the inciting incident that led to this career.
Right.
Marissa, let's talk a little bit as we wind up our conversation about the flip side of that rosy outlook. And in your many years of experience in this field, you've seen a couple of major downturns. What happens and what should folks do to navigate through the next one? Obviously, nobody can predict the future. We don't know when there's a contraction in the general economy. What do franchise operators and franchisors need to understand from the bank's perspective to help them? Is it really just come down to keep that dry powder, or what else do they need to do?
Don't over leverage. I can't say that enough, because if you're over leveraged when things start to slow down, you're going to have some problems. My niche of franchise is quick service restaurant, which tends to be somewhat recession proof. But what I've seen in my years and in franchise is that it's not so much the economy, because what we're seeing are economic swings that are 10 years. They go like in 10-year spurts, and that's a lot of time. But you see concepts go through ups and downs. There might be bad press. There might be a foodborne illness scandal. There might be political incorrectness with some, concepts where they've fallen out of favor because there was some scandal related to that. And it's how those franchises weather those storms. And as a banker, you have to go on defense when that happens, because there's really nothing you can do except know that you've underwritten everything as well as you can. And then you just have to work with the client until the franchise system recovers. That's the distinction. Sometimes you're going to have a great operation, but the franchise system suffers because of some unforeseen force. And as a banker, you've got to underwrite well and make sure and try not to just jump on every deal that comes your way if it's going to over-leverage the client, because if you're over-leveraged, then you don't have the flexibility when you need it.
Yeah. Really valuable perspective. And this is a fascinating conversation. I look forward to seeing how these things play out. Chad Barnett, if people want to learn more about your company or about the Subway Kids and Sports of Arizona, where do they go online or anywhere to find more information?
Oh, you threw a hard one at me. I think it's subwaykidsandsportsaz.com, I think.
They can
Google it and they can find it.
Fabulous. And of course, you're just a sandwich away at a shop near you. Thank you very much, Chad, for being here. I appreciate your comments and your conversation.
Thanks for having us, Adrian.
Marissa Felker, Franchise Banking Manager at Washington Federal, with a unique program. Where do people learn more about it and get the information they need, or how do they contact you?
The first thing they can do is go to WashingtonFederal.com, and there's a section about franchise that has an outline there. And of course, you can contact me directly at Washington Federal, and it's Marissa.Felker at WAF, as in Frank, D as in dog, .com. That's my email, and I'm very responsive. So even if someone has questions and doesn't actually have a financing in mind, I'm happy to answer any questions that they might have.
Thank you for being here. I appreciate
it very much.
Jeff Wolf, you are a national franchise attorney at Quarles & Brady. You have unique expertise in this area. Where do people learn more about the services or how to get in touch?
People can access our firm website, which is quarles.com, Q-U-A-R-L-E-S.com. And within the website, there is pretty easy to find find my bio, which we'll go into a lot more detail about what the depth of my experience, where I could be contacted at jeffrey.wolf@quarles.com.
Marvelous. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, I'm Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.